We would like to take a moment to thank our sponsor, Preborn. When a mother meets her baby on an ultrasound and hears their heartbeat, it's a divine connection, and the majority of the time, she will choose life. But she can't do it without our help. Preborn needs us, the pro-life community, to come alongside her. One ultrasound is just $28. To donate, dial #250 and say the keyword baby, or visit preborn.com.
AFA Action takes attacks on the family seriously. The enemies of the family constantly employ new tactics to try to sneak past our radar. They know if we stand together, their evil plans will fail. Your gift to AFA Action allows us to stay vigilant against their onslaught. And if you give this month, you'll receive access to the Cultural Institute video, When Your Faith is Illegal, by Frank Harbor on AFA Stream as our thanks. You can make your gift today at afaaction.net.
Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
I love talking about the things of God because of truth and the biblical worldview.
The U.S. Constitution obligates our government to preserve and protect the rights that our founders recognize come from God, our Creator, not our government. I believe that Scripture in the Bible is very clear that God is the one that raised up each of you, and God has allowed us to be brought here to this specific moment in time.
This is Jenna Ellis in the Morning.
Good morning. Good morning. It is Monday, November 11th, and happy Veterans Day to all of our men and women in the United States Armed Forces. We are so grateful for your service, your sacrifice, and your love for this country. We salute you and celebrate you today. Thank you so much. And there is so much news to get to this morning, not the least of which is that President-elect Donald Trump is staffing his administration already, with the first pick being Susie Wiles, one of his campaign managers, into the role as his chief of staff, which is history-making, as she will be the first woman to ever hold that position. He also announced that Tom Homan will be his border czar and responsible for enforcing the border, as he is going to be a lot tougher on immigration than Joe Biden was. And hopefully we will see a repeat, but even stronger on the border than he was his first administration. And there are reports suggesting that it is down to maybe three or four top picks for Secretary of State, which include former Ambassador Rick Grenell, includes a couple of senators, and also potentially Vivek Ramaswamy. So we will see about that. There are also a couple of people that Trump has already excluded very publicly from a second administration, which include former UN ambassador and South Carolina Governor Nikki Haley, and also former Secretary of State Mike Pompeo. The president posted on X over the weekend that they will not be invited back to roles. So a lot of things that are going on, but looking forward to January and getting the country back on track. So let's welcome in Mark Lauder, who's the chief communications officer for the America First Policy Institute. And Mark, it seems like Trump in classic fashion is just hitting the ground running and wasting no time with his political appointees.
No, absolutely. Good morning, Jenna. You know, it's remarkable. I was there in 2016 when he first transitioned in, and you only have about 74, 75 days between the election and when you actually take office. And when you're switching between parties like this, I've often compared it to like a hostile corporate takeover, and it's like the largest on the planet because you have conservatives taking over from the swamp. And so getting right out of the gate, naming Susie as the chief of staff, great pick. Also, obviously, Tom Homan. I don't know if Tom's ever been to Europe, but I can tell you he's been to the border many times and we've been many times more. And also seeing word that, you know, in multiple public reporting, I don't know if it's true or not, obviously, that Elise Stefanik is going to be his choice for UN ambassador. You know, a lot of great choices there, and even more to come.
Yeah. And, you know, interesting you mentioned Elise Stefanik, because this kind of raises the question, Mark Lauder, about the metric by which Trump is at least publicly maybe, and who knows what all goes into it privately. I mean, you know, you and I have been there. And I think, as we know, Trump is Trump and will make his decisions based on whatever factors he considers. But at least publicly, there's a lot of chatter on the media and social media about just loyalty to Trump being the most important metric rather than potentially actual fidelity to conservative policy. And it's interesting to me because when Elise Stefanik was running for party chair and basically ousted Liz Cheney for that position, there were a lot of people, including then Vice Chair Mike Johnson, who's now Speaker of the House, that was publicly saying, you know, Elise Stefanik during Trump's first term only voted with him 78% of the time compared to Liz Cheney, who is, you know, MAGA is no fan of her, but she voted at 93%. So just that contrast, I think, is an indication, though, that couldn't there be people, obviously not Liz Cheney, but other members of the GOP, like representatives and so forth, that have an even better voting record, not just 78% of the time. Do you think that Trump should only consider loyalty to Trump, or should it be to an overall policy agenda?
Well, I think ultimately it's going to be to his policy agenda, and that's what he's going to be seeing. You know, one of the challenges, and this is a challenge for any political party, but especially true, obviously, in the Republican Party, is you have members that are from varying districts that are a varying need. Obviously, Elise Stefanik from New York has a much different constituency than, say, well, obviously Liz Cheney, but any conservative in, say, maybe a deep red state. And so sometimes, you know, you find yourself, with a conflict there. But the great thing I take from that is whether it's Elise Stefanik, whether it's somebody from more of a ruby red Republican district, is that the thing I see from conservatives right now is that we see that they're supposed to represent us. It's not supposed to be the other way around. And I think that's the big lesson from 2016, from 2024, is that the American people are tired of being told we have to adjust our views to the leadership, as opposed to the leadership having to adjust their views for us.
And that's a great point, Mark, because, you know, one of the things that you and I have always said about the, you know, our experience, of course, with Trump and especially looking at his first administration, I still believe that he was one of the most underserved presidents, at least in his first administration, through some hires that actively worked against him in his administration. So I get and I support why loyalty to him and his agenda should be part of the overall contemplation. It shouldn't be the only consideration, in my view. Obviously, you want really good conservatives. I would also hope and pray that good Christians would be in those roles on especially some of the social issues and some of those things. But this also gets us to the other really important election that's coming up, which is for Senate Majority Leader. So it's really down to three that are running, which is Senator John Thune, John Cornyn, and then Rick Scott. And for a lot of all of the rhetoric that's out there around, you know, why different positions and, you know, other things, AFA Action, by the way, has said very publicly that that Rick Scott deserves that opportunity. And I think that is one very clear race that you can have somebody like a Rick Scott that will support Trump's agenda, or you can go with kind of the Rhino McConnell era holdover and replacement, and then see, like in the first term, the Senate, even though it's GOP controlled, not really helping Trump get his political appointments through and some of these other priorities.
No, I mean, and that's really the tug in terms of all of this, because whether it's for Speaker of the House, whether it's for Senate Majority Leader, you know, they are representing obviously the majority of their caucus, and who are elected to represent, you know, obviously the people. And so it's going to be very interesting. You know, the Senate is very prickly in terms of its leadership, in terms of how it handles things. And I'll be very interested to see how this comes out for two reasons. One is because you can put a lot of pressure, and I know there's a lot of conservative groups out there that are voicing their support for Senator Scott and calling on the Senate to name him as the majority leader, but it's ultimately a secret ballot. So whether the senators are saying one thing publicly, you know, you're never going to know who actually votes for him or who votes for someone else. I'm very interested to see how this dynamic plays out. Ultimately, to me, as long as you're going to be moving forward with the president's agenda, the president's nominees, whether that be for the courts or whether that be for the cabinet, that's my most important aspect of it, because you only really have about 100 days, or maybe I'll even give him a year, before, obviously, you know, as a second term leader, before the Congress is going to do what the Congress does, which is focus on their reelections in the midterms. And then, of course, even though we haven't even taken office again, it's on to 2028. It's a really tight window to get the things done that need to be done. And whomever takes those leadership roles, I hope they are firmly committed to moving the president's agenda, because he has a majority, not just of the Electoral College, but of the American people, who have said, this is what we want.
Yeah, really well said. And hopefully, as much as the Democrats, of course, are going to try to paint this as, you know, kind of a lame duck 4 years because he doesn't have another election, I don't think that there's anything lame duck about Donald Trump. He's going to want to go in there and he's going to want to actually get things done. And he needs people around him that are going to push that agenda. And so I'm speaking with Mark Lauder, who's the Chief Communications Officer for the America First Policy Institute. And Mark, as you've said, you know, you were there during the first transition in 2016. How already, just in this first week, do you see the picks and some of just the transition, and especially Susie Wiles? Now let's talk about that. You know, being chief of staff, how do you see this differing from 2016?
Oh my goodness, Jenna, it's night and day. It really is, because I mean, you have to remember, in 2016, you still had a good deal of Republicans that were kind of keeping then-President-elect Trump at arm's length. They wouldn't campaign with him. There was obviously lots of talk of replacing him, late in that campaign. And he didn't have a huge Washington power base. He was not a creature of Washington, D.C. He was not a big player in Washington, D.C. circles during his time in the private sector. So he didn't come in with this group of allies who knew how to get things done. So that's why when he came in as president-elect, he went with Reince Priebus, the RNC chair, as his first White House chief of staff, who then took mostly people, yes, from the campaign, but also people from the RNC, and kind of staffed an administration. And it was really a hodgepodge of people who'd been there for a long time, along with a few of the guerrilla warriors that were there with Trump. And it just didn't really work out. He also didn't have a huge policy backing behind him. And so, obviously, where I work at the America First Policy Institute, those were the people who were right there in the White House, in the agencies, up until the very last day of the first Trump term. They've been working for the last 4 years, writing white papers and doing all the fun things that think tanks do, but getting all the things ready to go should there be a second term, or whomever was going to be the next America First candidate. And so now he has all of that to draw upon, in addition to having been there. He knows the key positions. He knows who's in it for the right reasons, who's in it for their personal reasons. And he knows those key players, not only in the White House, but at the agencies. And then because of places like the work at our place at America First, you know how to get things done. Because just because a president signs an executive order, what's got to go to an agency, or many times multiple agencies, to actually be executed? And then how do you get it through the bureaucracy? You have to know what positions to fill, how to move the levers of government, because just because he puts his name on the paper doesn't mean anything until they actually start executing on it and enforcing it.
Yeah, really well said. And I can see that contrast. I mean, I know that during the election, a lot of people talked about personnel and policy. And I do think that Trump is going in for this term, obviously, with a lot more experience actually in the Oval Office and actually seeing, you know, what he could improve from the first term. And while he got a lot of things done, he can get a lot more done in a second term, especially with that trifecta that he had in 2016 that, of course, in a lot of ways actually worked against him, unfortunately. So hopefully day one, though, he can go in and have some of those executive orders that will reverse some of the Biden administration terrible policy will be ready on day one. Just in the last minute we have with you, Mark Lauder, do you expect that we will see some of those executive orders signed to just hit the ground running day one?
Oh, I'm sure there will. Now, it may not actually be technically day one. It might be day two. It might be week one. But I'll tell you, if I remember, and I'm going off memory here, I believe there were like two executive orders he signed in like the first 10 days, first week or so. I bet you that number will be up there in, the dozens, if not hundreds, because I think there are many places that are getting those executive actions ready. It's ultimately going to be up to him and his team to decide what is he going to sign, when is he going to sign it, and then how do you get it out there to execute it, because you also need confirmed cabinet secretaries to be able to do it, and that obviously takes time and work in the Senate.
And this is why the Senate leadership matters. So, Mark Lauder, thanks so much. And this is where you, listeners, can help. Call your senator today. Tell them to support Rick Scott for the Senate Majority Leader, because he will work with Trump, I believe, more than Thune or Cornyn. And there are a lot of conservatives that are backing Rick Scott. And that majority needs to get in place so that all of these things can get through the Senate. And we'll be right back with more here on Jenna Ellis in the Morning. Could the fate of America's children be tied to the fate of our nation itself? Much like the abortionists who end the lives of the unborn, the left is determined to undermine the pro-life movement. First, they target the babies. Then they come for the rest of us. Preborn stands as a beacon of hope for the most defenseless among us, preborn babies. Every day, Preborn's network of clinics rescue, on average, over 200 babies while surrounding expectant mothers with God's love and offering a free ultrasound. Rescuing the miracle of life has never been more crucial as we navigate this time of moral decline in our nation. Will you join Preborn in protecting the least among us? For just $28, you can sponsor an ultrasound and give a mother the chance to choose life, not only for her baby, but for herself. An ultrasound doubles a baby's chance at life. To donate securely, dial #250 and say the keyword baby. That's #250 baby. Or go to preborn.com. That's preborn.com/AFR. Preborn.com/AFR.
Welcome back to Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
Welcome back. Well, Daily Wire broke the story on Friday that internal messages obtained show a FEMA official ordered relief workers in Florida in the wake of Hurricane Milton not to help houses with Trump signs. So clear political discrimination. Daily Wire says that whistleblowers say relief workers were told it was, quote unquote, best practice to pass over houses advertising Trump. This included Trump yard signs and other and flags and so forth. The workers would enter into the system that they made no contact with the residents, blaming the directive Trump sign, no contact per leadership. And so the FEMA administrator, Deanne Criswell, said on Saturday, this coming from the New York Post, quote, "This is a clear violation of FEMA's core values and principles to help people regardless of their political affiliation." And she added, "This employee has been terminated and we have referred the matter to the Office of Special Counsel." And so there will also be a congressional hearing that is currently slated for November 19th. And joining me now to discuss this and more is the Daily Wire reporter who originally broke this story, Leif Lemahieu. So Leif, good morning. And what exactly happened here?
Good morning. Thanks so much for having me on today.
Thank you.
So basically, we spoke with whistleblowers who told us that they were instructed by their supervisor, both verbally and in the group chat, to avoid homes advertising Trump as they were working in Lake Placid, Florida. And now this isn't a part of Florida that had voted about 70% for Trump on Tuesday. So it's a very Trump supportive county. And they told me that they ended up skipping around 20 houses with Trump signs or Trump flags, and they were just very upset that they were instructed to do this. So we spoke with them, and now that employee who issued that directive has been fired.
And we know, Leif, that also Governor Ron DeSantis has instructed the Florida Emergency Division or Emergency Division of Emergency Management, and I'm forgetting the exact acronym there, but basically the Florida level, that there will be an investigation as well. And, you know, this is absolutely ridiculous from the perspective that, I mean, FEMA as a governmental agency, everybody pays tax dollars. There should be no political viewpoint discrimination. So what type of accountability can actually happen here?
That's a great question. Well, immediately after our report, a lot of investigations have been launched. So you mentioned Florida, the state's Division of Emergency Management is investigating, and Ron DeSantis has ordered the White House and FEMA to preserve any communications that they have regarding this matter. And Tennessee announced yesterday that they would also be probing whether maybe Tennesseans were discriminated in recent response to Hurricane Helene. And the House Homeland Security said they were going to be looking into it. And the House Oversight Committee has already launched a investigation as well and plans to bring in FEMA Administrator Criswell for a hearing on November 19.
And what do we expect from that congressional hearing in terms of oversight? Because I think for a lot of listeners, you know, there are a lot of these congressional hearings that, you know, maybe good television, but then does that actually change policy and can it actually result in accountability?
Yeah, that kind of depends on what answers we were able to get. The outstanding questions are when the federal government found out about this guidance and what they did about it when they first found out about it. For example, a whistleblower complaint was filed on October 27, but it appears that no action was taken until after our report on November 8. So who all in the Department of Homeland Security knew about the guidance? When did they know about it? And if they did know about it, why didn't they act sooner? And our sources told us that Washington was just moved to another county. And so that means that they seem to know about it, but they didn't take any action until our report was published.
And that to me is very fascinating. I'm speaking with Leif LeMahieu, who is the Daily Wire reporter that broke this story on the FEMA abuses against Trump supporters in the wake of Hurricane Milton and possibly even Helene. And, you know, as those investigations are ongoing, because you know, this is really what journalism should be all about, and especially investigative journalism, to see what happened, hold these people accountable, because it does appear that, you know, this FEMA worker, this manager was just moved to a different county rather than actual action taken until this story broke. And so how important could that be in terms of Governor DeSantis's investigation?
Yeah, that would be very important, because if we're able to get communication showing that they knew about this earlier, then that means this is even a bigger scandal, because they knew that an employee was discriminating against a specific political group, and then they didn't take any action and maybe even just tried to sweep it under the rug, which if they knew about it for over a week and they only moved to another county, that raises a whole lot of other questions.
Yeah, it really does raise a lot of those questions. And so this story broke on Friday. And then, you know, now over the weekend, we've seen the FEMA response, and then we're moving forward, you know, here on Monday. And so what else in terms of some of those questions are you currently investigating for Daily Wire?
We're looking into whether this was actually an isolated incident or not, because that is what FEMA has currently say they believe. They've said it's an isolated incident, but we are looking into whether that is true or not, whether this happened in other parts of Florida, whether it happened in Tennessee. And that's the big question. Is it actually isolated, or is it just one example of maybe a bigger problem at FEMA, which FEMA has taken a lot of criticism in the wake of these hurricanes in recent weeks. And so we hope to find out more about whether this was just a one incident or if it was a broader problem and just symbolic of the bureaucracy in Washington.
Yeah, that's incredibly important. And I think that for so many people who not only, you know, voted for Donald Trump, but want to see, you know, across the board, the government not weaponize these government agencies against particularly conservatives, but no viewpoint. I mean, FEMA should not have gone around and said, okay, we're going to discriminate against anyone who has a Harris Walz sign, for example. I mean, that's not a legitimate action of the government. And so is the weaponization of government committee that is being helmed by Jim Jordan in investigating this or holding their own hearings as well? Do we know that yet?
We do not know that yet, but the House Oversight Committee does have a hearing scheduled already for the 19th.
Okay. And so for these 20 or so homes that have been that were passed over and were denied the FEMA aid in the wake of this story, what happens to them? I mean, has FEMA said that they will go back and actually look at whether those people qualify? And do we know if there's any other potential lawsuit action or, you know, anything from those people that were targeted?
FEMA has said that they will go back and reach out to any homes that were skipped and see if they qualify, those people will qualify for federal aid.
Well, that, yeah, and that's great. And again, I'm talking with Leif Lemahieu, who is the Daily Wire reporter, and you can find that story on Daily Wire. This was probably the biggest news story over the weekend. And one of the interesting tangential side notes of this as well is that a lot of people have also posted the New York Times that said a fact check when Trump had claimed that the federal response to Hurricane Helene was not working out well for Republicans. And the New York Times headline said this: Trump's false claims about the federal response to Hurricane Helene. The former president falsely accused the Biden administration of spending disaster funding on migrants, neglecting areas that had voted for Republicans, and ignoring a call from a Republican governor. So obviously the New York Times has not walked that back, but they are in kind of some hot water here over that particular headline. And this is where, you know, some of the alleged fact checks from other outlets really do seem to be intentionally biased.
Yeah, that's correct. We had all these headlines about false claims about FEMA, and now it turns out that they appear to be correct. And now all those media outlets have covered our story and covered it pretty down the middle. New York Times wrote up about the FEMA employee being fired after our report. Washington Post has covered it. So the mainstream media has covered this report because it's been so egregious. But whether that results in any thoughts about their previous coverage, I guess we'll find out.
Yeah, well, no retraction yet so far, which it's kind of typical, I guess, for the New York Times and some of these other outlets. And have we seen President-elect Donald Trump respond at all to this or comment in any way on the story?
The president himself has not yet commented, to my knowledge, but Donald Trump Jr. has responded to our report and just called out the blatant discrimination of a FEMA employee in this situation.
All right. Well, Leif Lemahieu, thank you so much for your work on this and for simply, you know, holding accountable the government agencies and breaking this story. We will be following everything from the Daily Wire on this, and we'll be right back with more here on Jenna Ellis in the Morning. And again, you can go to Daily Wire, read that story. And this is absolutely one of the things that the weaponization of government committee and the entire conservative frustration with the Biden administration clearly shows. I mean, this is just yet another example of how the Biden-Harris administration targeted conservatives and punished them for their political beliefs and being outspoken. Because, hey, if you had a Trump sign or flag in your yard, you're passed over for government assistance. I mean, that is absolutely absurd. And I really hope that accountability happens, not not just, you know, some really great bombastic sort of hearings on television. We really need some accountability here. So we'll be right back with more here on Jenna Ellis in the Morning.
Welcome back to Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
Welcome back. And we have been talking about this presidential transition and the next couple of months until President-elect Donald Trump returns to the White House and having a team around him that will implement conservative policy priorities and ensuring, of course, that the Senate leadership is on board with that. And hopefully, as there are still a lot of inexplicably outstanding House races, the vote should all be counted by now. I mean, this is just utterly absurd that some states don't have their results in still. But hopefully that margin as well will grow in terms of the elected officials. But what should the conservative policy look like and how can that be moved forward compared even to the first administration? So let's welcome in our very dear friend, Abe Hamilton, who is the host of the Hamilton Corner right here on American Family Radio Network. So, Abe, good morning. And, you know, first, kind of, you know, your reaction to the last week. I mean, I think that this whole just absolute repudiation of the left's extremism, the Marxism, the LGBTQ agenda, the weaponization of government. I mean, all of this was just a resounding no from America. And I love that.
Good morning, Jenna. You're absolutely right. It's amazing to see what has happened. The thing that continues to ring in my mind was that one portion of the night on CNN's coverage when Jake Tapper is talking to John King, and he said, and Jake Tapper asked, is there any county in the country where Kamala Harris outperformed Joe Biden from 2020? And John King says, let's see. And then he pulls up the graphic. He's like, no, not one. And Jake Tapper literally goes, holy smokes, not one. And he's like, not one. There's not a single county. And what it is, it's what you said. It's a massive repudiation of the leftward lurch of the Democrat Party, of the culture, of the punditry class, all in one fell swoop. And it is encouraging to see, but also sobering, because my posture on this whole thing is God is bestowing his mercy upon our nation, giving us a reprieve for the express purposes for primary the Lord's church really to be active in making disciples in this time period that we've been granted due to this clearly remarkable historical election.
Amen and amen to that. And I think that we have had a reprieve almost in spite of largely the church's lack of engagement. And, you know, you and I for a while before the election were sounding the alarm among, you know, many others. I know Jack Hibbs and, you know, other pastors around the country about the Barna survey that talked about how many millions of self-identified church-going Christians were going to sit it out and how many pastors were not talking about the abortion initiatives that were on the ballot in their states and so many more. So so before we get into some of the policy that we'd like to see from the Trump administration, what do you think is the message overall to pastors to stand up? I mean, there are secular people or the kind of the godless populace that still understand a nation needs borders and understand that family first and all this. They're willing to stand up stronger than some American pastors.
Yeah. And the unfortunate reality, I think many of them, those who are not standing up, have been kind of manipulated by our context. You know, God gave us his command to execute his commission. He gave us salt and light duty in Matthew 5, but he also gave us the context to execute that within based on Acts chapter 17. We are Christians in America. We have opportunities that Christians in China, for example, don't have. It's not as if our commission is different. We just have a different context. And I think some have conflated and misconstrued our context with being something that cannot be reconciled with the biblical mandates. And so they try to wax, you know, nonpartisan or try to be neutral. Well, the reality is, it doesn't matter how often politicians discuss things that are germane to to biblical doctrine, it doesn't reclassify those notions. You know, the sanctity of human life is not an inherently political issue. Sexual morality is not an inherently political issue. Loving your neighbor is not an inherently political issue. Having respect for the Imago Dei and private property is not an inherently political issue. I know people might try to recast them as that, but they are not. And so when we have people who are called to be shepherds, watchmen on the wall, who abdicate that position, there's a neglect that reveals a kind of yielding to a manipulation, not properly understanding the contextual aspects that God has given us as Christians in America, with which he expects us to do no less than the Apostle Paul, using everything at our disposal to put the light on the lampstand.
Amen. And so well said, Abe. I love that, that our commission is not dependent on context, because even if Kamala Harris had won, our commission as Christians wouldn't change in that context either. And so this is where the American church has become largely dependent on politics, or they want to get out of politics altogether because they think that that means that you have to endorse red versus blue or one or the other. And that's for whatever reason, whether it's too dirty or they don't want to. And they say, well, we want to have a separation of church and state, which is buying into that ridiculous myth that is nowhere in American constitutional history other than an overreaching Supreme Court couple of decisions. They want to just take away from the commission and have it dependent on context. And so let's get to the policy, because our context actually for the policy side is a lot better in a Trump administration than it would have been in a Kamala Harris administration, or than it was for the last 4 years in a Biden administration, because hopefully we will be able to advance conservative policies that are grounded not just in godless populism, but on genuine biblical values. And so from, you know, the first 100 days of the new Trump administration, what should be the priorities?
Yeah, and let me just say one last thing about context, and because what I was meaning by that is that it is the Apostle Paul's awareness of the civic mandate and the Roman appellate laws that allowed for him to advance the gospel to where we have scripture like Philippians chapter 4, verse 22, where the saints of Caesar's household, the saints greet you, including those in Caesar's household. We don't have saints in Caesar's household without Paul using his appellate rights. You know, we it's no different than Daniel and his friends, Azariah, Hananiah, and Mishael, using the awareness of what the Lord prophetic revealed to them and their placement within Babylonian provincial government that allowed them to do what God called them to do within that particular assignment. Now, getting to the policy front, it is imperative that the Trump administration hits the ground running in these first 2 years. As you know very well, an entire third of the Senate will be up for re-election again, where there'll be more Republican senators defending their incumbency to Democrat senators. It'll have the same opportunity for the Democrats to do what happened with Republicans this time in just 2 years from now. So the ground has to be hit with a zeal, with a passion, with a fervor running. President Trump doesn't have any time to ramp up. He needs to hit the ground running with these policy prerogatives, because, as you know very well as I know, the second half of this administration is basically going to be a lame duck period for the Trump administration. And so things that have to happen immediately, I think his policy positions he's presenting, like the Department of Education, that needs to be addressed. The border needs to be addressed immediately. You know, the other things that he's presenting that need to happen, you cannot wait, which is why this election Wednesday in the Senate is so vitally important, because the question as to whether or not there will be an ally to the Trump administration as opposed to an opponent to the Trump administration leading the Republican majority in the Senate is a vital issue that must be addressed immediately.
Yeah, and speaking of that Senate election, there are a lot of the more MAGA conservatives and I think just conservatives overall that would like to see Rick Scott in that position rather than Thune or Cornyn, who are also running. So AFA Action has, you know, sent out some emails and some other things on that, and I know that Walker Wildman and others have posted a lot on social media about it. But then some of the pushback from even some of the conservatives are saying, okay, you guys are all supporting Rick Scott for this, and just because he's a little bit better than the other two, maybe, or you're not even sure why, what would you say to the people who are still kind of tentative about a Rick Scott candidacy?
Yeah, you have to use the ones who put themselves out for it. You know, I'm sure some might want other people to run for it, but to date, the only people who have said that they are actively running for the Republican leadership of the Senate are John Thune, John Cornyn, and Scott among the senators. You know, so my first response would be, if you want somebody else to put their hat in the ring, you need to have them to put their hat in the ring, first of all. Secondarily, I would say that we have to go with the most conservative possible candidate. Do we really want, you know, a Mitch McConnell disciple, a Mitch McConnell acolyte to fill this position? People often forget that Mitch McConnell opposed the Trump administration in 2016, you know, actively. Do you want a repeat of that? We talk about, you know, draining the swamp, but often the swamp has revealed itself in Republican garb, you know, and so it's vitally important. I think it's kind of unfair for this Senate majority leadership election to be pushed up to this date because you have incumbent senators who were just elected that won't get a chance to have a say in who will be a part of the Republican leadership. So I would say we have to go with the most conservative possibility available to us, and we want to make sure that there's somebody who is willing to go along with and to aid and bolster the Trump administration's agenda as opposed to opposing it.
And that is exactly true, that elections are always a closed universe of possibilities. You can only choose from among those running. And that was also true for the presidential election. I know that, you know, people, yeah. Even including me, I mean, I very openly supported Governor DeSantis in the primary, and I was very happy to do that. And then when it came to the general, you know, he wasn't running. He wasn't an option. So, you know, so we always have to go with the best available candidate in any particular election, whether that's a primary, it's a general, or it's something like this type of election. And I'm speaking with Abe Hamilton, who, you know, is so well spoken. He really should have his own show. And guess what? He does. He is the host of the Hamilton Corner right here on American Family Radio Network. And you can catch that streaming on X, Facebook, and also on our free app from 6 to 7 Eastern time or 5 to 6 Central. And Abe, I also want your take on this. Speaking of the Senate majority leader race, you know, we have kind of relegated the vice presidential role into kind of a ceremonial, or, you know, come in only when, you know, we need the tie-breaking vote. But Article 1, starting in Section 3.4, says the Vice President of the United States shall be the President of the Senate, but shall have no vote unless they be equally divided. The Senate shall choose their other officers and also President pro tempore in the absence of the Vice President, or when he shall exercise the office of the President of the United States. I have posted a lot, and I know other, you know, constitutional scholars that I respect have also posted that J.D. Vance, as a current sitting senator but VP-elect, could have a much more active role in championing and actually whipping the Senate in terms of advancing Trump's agenda. And he could basically step into a role of maybe not, you know, elected as the majority leader, that's currently just a current sitting senator, but he could preside over the Senate and actually fulfill that responsibility and that power that is given to him in Article 1. And then I don't think it would matter quite as much who the GOP elects as their Senate majority leader, because then you actually have a champion in the U.S. Senate, which is the vice president.
Yeah, I think you bring up a good point, and it reminds me of a bit of historical precedent when John Adams was George Washington's vice president, and he functioned in that role. The Senate Majority Leader is not a constitutionally mandated office. I know some people may not be aware of that, but it is not a constitutionally mandated office. And the impact of J.D. Vance presiding over the Senate, which would require him to be physically present in the Senate during session, would probably take him away from some other duties. But I think it would be important for President Trump to have a clear emissary, if you will, to the U.S. Senate, physically present as often as possible, to let the Senate know, hey, you can have your intramural, if you will, intra-house delegations, but J.D. Vance is my appointee to oversee the things that transpire in the Senate, and you all will be able to report to me through him. I think he could function in that capacity, and I believe, as you pointed out, the Constitution bears out. It doesn't have to be limited to a ceremonial function if it will be utilized with him being physically present as often as possible during session. And I think that's one of the tangible ways the Trump administration can demonstrate its efforts to hold the Senate accountable for going along with his agenda in terms of the Republicans in the Senate as a majority.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. And if we go back to the original intent of the Senate, I mean, senators used to not be, as you well know, Abe, and for listeners, though, they used to not be popularly elected. That wasn't until the 17th Amendment. I would love to see that repealed. Wouldn't that be amazing for Trump administration?
So would I.
And we could get back to the Senate actually representing the state legislatures. And so for the vice president that the Constitution requires in this role, the entire point of that is that the vice president was elected through the Electoral College process, which this all originally was not intended to be a popular vote. That is for the House. And then that's why the House representatives that are apportioned by the proportionality of the citizens and the population, then they choose their speaker, which is a constitutional office. But the president of the Senate was mandated in the Constitution for that purpose, understanding that the Senate isn't just a super house. It is why advice and consent of the Senate for presidential appointees, all of those things, judicial nominations that go only through the Senate, it's because the states were supposed to have a much, much stronger voice in Washington that has basically just been neutered over the past, you know, 100 plus years. So in terms of federalism, how could a Trump administration not just focus on, you know, the priorities for America, but, you know, Trump ran in 2016 on returning power back to the people. And I think a huge part of that, if we are returning power back to the people, we need to return it back to the states, which are much more responsive and close to the people.
Yeah, and I think a great example of that is what President Trump has put out just over the weekend, his policy to abolish the Department of Education. And I know that causes some people to go, "Ooh, what, Department of Education?" Well, the reality is the Department of Education didn't exist prior to 1980. It's a very recent phenomenon. And secondarily, it existed to establish uniform educational standards for our public schools primarily. How has that been going? You know, it will be much better than $90+ billion that are allocated through the Department of Education for that to be distributed directly to the states. Every state has its own Department of Education. There's no need to have this pass through a federal bureaucracy because we need to get this in the hands of the people that constitutionally are supposed to handle this. This is not something that the founders envisioned that will be handled at the federal level. The states who are closest to the citizens, closest to the people, and most importantly, closest to the students and their families should be the ones directly involved in shaping education policy. No need to have a federal pass-through. We can still allocate the funds as needed, but just do it directly to the states and see what type of outcomes we have when the government closest to the people is most involved in helping the people advocate and execute these policies.
What an amazing concept, you know, that maybe our founders had too. Yeah. And this is some of these priorities are what I hope that the new Trump administration will be very responsive to. And even though Trump had said in the first administration that he was going to dismantle the Department of Ed, obviously that didn't happen, but he has another opportunity to do some of these things that would be very beneficial for America. And in the last few minutes I have with Abe Hamilton, and definitely listen to his show. This is one of my favorites. I can say that on American Family Radio Network because he also preaches the word of God, and that's so instrumental to our lives as Christians and being able to execute our commission in our daily lives. So you can listen to the Hamilton Corner. If you miss it live, you can also go hear it on demand on our AFR free app. But let's also talk about the GOP kind of watering down some of these issues like life and marriage, the sanctity of marriage between one man and one woman. Moving forward now, this is post-election. There can be a lot of Christians in the Trump administration. I hope there will be. How should the Trump administration face those issues when, you know, Trump himself really isn't kind of the standard bearer, at least as much as we would like him to be on some of those issues?
Yeah, I think it's vitally important because we're faced with a prospect of having a conservative movement really transmogrify into, as you mentioned, a godless populism, a definition of what conservatism is. And that's important to understand. Our founders knew it. George Washington knew it. He lists in his farewell address lots of important things that are necessary, that are vital. But there are two things that he said that are indispensable to our constitutional Republican form of government. Those two things are religion and morality. And for people to think that we can have some idea of conservatism that violates and opposes the word of God, that I'm simply going to tell you, that's a fool's errand. When you even get down to fiscal policy, why is it immoral? Why is it wrong for the government to forcibly confiscate the wealth and private property of citizens? It goes back to the Imago Dei, and that private property is something that derives from the mind of God. Ultimately, every policy prerogative is undergirded by a moral foundation. That it's inescapable. And so we need to be intentional and need to be watchmen on the wall yet again to not allow quote unquote conservatism to militate towards this godless, paganistic pursuit of self-aggrandizement that rejects the reality of biblical truth. It is noteworthy that we had a massive Electoral College landslide victory. However, all across the country, it really was only 2 to 3 percentage points in the battleground states. And even in Florida, thankfully, Amendments 3 and 4 failed. But Amendment 4, the abortion amendment, only failed because the threshold was 60%. There were still 57% of red Floridians who voted to amend the Constitution to enshrine unfettered abortion in the state constitution. We need to be aware of that and continue to press biblical truth as we advocate for policy.
Amen to that as well. Abraham Hamilton III, so appreciate your fight and stance for biblical truth. And that just proves that, you know, just because somebody calls themselves a Republican doesn't necessarily mean they have a biblical worldview. And it's worldview that matters. This is why Abe and I love working for the American Family Association that puts truth as the highest value, because truth is the person of God. That is our standard, regardless of party or person or politician. That is the standard that we have to uphold. And we get the opportunity to push that further over the next 4 years. So you can always reach me and my team, Jenna@AFR.net. And again, happy Veterans Day to all of the wonderful people who serve our country.
The views and opinions expressed in this broadcast may not necessarily reflect those of the American Family Association or American Family Radio.
We'd like to thank our sponsors, including Preborn. Preborn has rescued over 200,000 babies from abortion, and every day their network clinics rescue 200 babies' lives. Will you join Preborn in loving and supporting young moms in crisis? Save a life today. Go to preborn.com.